We're looking at the reign of Ahaz, king of Judah. And last week we were we really spent the entire time looking at the history from God's commandments, the history from the practice of those Gentile nations that were in the land of Canaan, going back before the Israelites entered into that land, and what persisted there among them in their religious practices in worshiping idols throughout that time after Israel had conquered the land, their neighbors around them, namely and particularly the idolatrous practice, or the aspect of their idolatrous practice of sacrificing their own children in the fire. And God had commanded the children of Israel not to do that. And we looked at scriptures in Leviticus 18 and Deuteronomy 18, where he specifically mentioned that practice as one of the things, as one of the particular reasons why he was had pronounced that severe judgment of utter destruction on those nations, to have them utterly destroyed, where they would not, and then to give their land to the children of Israel, that came with the warning that if they followed those practices, that God would do that and remove them as well. And sadly, of course, that's exactly what happened, which is why we are looking at it now, because that practice, in spite of it being something really the lowest of the low, it would be, if somebody were wanting to try to find a practice, a form of wickedness that was any greater than to murder one's own children as part of their worship of idols, I don't know what would be worse. And looking at the way the Lord describes it in His Word, it would be very difficult to find something that He pinpoints as lower or worse than that, as He emphasized over and over again, which is why we went through that study last week, and looking at those scriptures where the Lord described what they were doing, and He says, and this is why He would remove them from the land. As we also reminded ourselves of, He had foretold to Abram back in Genesis 15 that he wasn't giving the land of Canaan to his descendants until the wickedness of the Amorites was full or complete. Well, when we have Leviticus 18 and he's describing the symptoms of a complete wickedness with those particular sins. And I mean, so if you want to learn about, well, what would be the indications that wickedness in a particular land or among a nation or kingdom had reached a level of completeness, what are the things to be looking out for? What are the things to try to recognize that indicate that? That there's quite a helpful list there throughout the entire 18th chapter of Leviticus on that very subject. As the Lord says, here are the things that these nations were doing. This is why I pronounced this judgment on them. You don't do any of these things that they were doing. If you do, then I'm going to do the same with you that I'm doing with them. I mean, it's that plain. But the chapter is filled with just a list of the particular forms. Much of it is the forms of sexual immorality there, homosexuality, and then the idolatrous practices and the shedding of innocent blood and murdering their children. And those are things that have a lot of the attention that's in Leviticus 18. What's frightening or concerning about that when you read a chapter like that? What's going on today? Yes, what's going on in our nation and our world today? What kinds of things do we see becoming more and more and more prevalent and common and accepted. And we did spend some time last week mentioning that. I mean, with the practice of abortion, where the children are killed in the womb. We have lots of scriptures to look at where the Lord regards those in the womb. I mean, He's made them, and they are His creation in the womb. And to kill a child in the womb, I mean, whether it's shedding the innocent blood within the womb or outside of the womb, I mean, as far as how God would view that, what would be the difference? And there's not. So we have our form of that practice that fills our land this very day, and it's very sad to see that, as well as the other forms of wickedness that are so much on really on the rampage in our world today. But all of that is if we are educated by God's word like we need to be, if we know the Lord's will like we should recognize all of those things as being very concerning markers of the degree of wickedness that we're sinking into. And what does that mean? What does that mean for us from a practical standpoint? What can we do about it? What's that? Well, we certainly can pray about it, and that's something very big we need to do, and we're instructed to do, particularly as it pertains to our authorities. When we look at 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 4, I mean, he tells us to pray for all men and for our authorities so that we can live those quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. Is it easier or more difficult to live those godly lives when this kind of wickedness is growing? I mean, obviously that makes that more difficult. So praying about that is something the Lord teaches and commands us to do. We also need to be very diligent in warning one another, exhorting one another while it is called today, lest any of us be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. I mean, as when it's all around us like that, and it's really looking at the language, and we're not going to go to Revelation 20 right now, but that chapter, he goes back to what's in Ezekiel 38 and 39, which was about Gog and Magog, and it is a symbolic battle there, but what it pertains to, or the application of it, when we see it in Revelation 20, is the camp of the saints. I mean, that's us, his holy ones. His church is surrounded. We're surrounded by a wicked world, and we have all the pressure and all the temptations there. Now, if we are steadfast and unmovable and are always abounding in the work of the Lord, who's going to prevail in the end? With all of the, with us surrounded and under attack by this wicked world, are we going to be defeated by the devil and his servants? Well, not if we remain steadfast. But that task, again, is something that is much more difficult when the wickedness is around it. What happens, I mean, when that leaven is all out there, how easy is it for it to get in among us? I mean, we know there's a great danger in that. That's why we're warned to exhort each other daily. So we do need to be praying. We need to be praying diligently every day. We need to be exhorting each other every day to help each other to keep ourselves and our children from getting pulled into the wickedness of this world. It's around us all the time. Can it become a part of our minds where it just doesn't even bother us anymore? For us to recognize and see that wickedness as it is. I mean, it can become very easy for us to accept things as, well, this is okay or normal, which it may be normal in the world, and it is becoming more and more normal, sadly, but it should never be normal to us, and it should not be something acceptable to us, any form of wickedness. So there's a lot to learn from that and things for us to think about in our own time, because we can see how it affected God's people here in this time. And that's really the point of why we're studying about this and looking at it, because this wasn't just something that was out there in the world. Did the Lord recognize when the people around them were engaging in this wickedness that that was a threat, as a potential influence on his people there, that they could learn the ways of the world, of those people, nations around them, and then start doing those things? Well, he said that in those words. He warned them about that and how they would be thorns in their sides, and how their children could learn the ways of those others, especially if they then married the children of these ones around them. That's why the Lord forbade that practice. He wanted them to remain holy and not to learn those wicked ways of their neighbors and follow them. But what did they do? Alas, they did it. And what happened in that northern kingdom of Israel, those 10 tribes that were under those kings, starting with Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and all the way down, and now we're into the reign of the last one, Hoshea. But what did those kings start doing? They started doing that practice of making their own children pass through the fire in their, as part of their idol worship. So they adopted that practice. We looked last week in 2 Kings 17. That was one of the things that God specifically mentioned, why he did ultimately destroy the northern kingdom of Israel. Those 10 tribes, that practice was part of it, which should not be a surprise, since when back in Leviticus 18, Deuteronomy 18, the Lord had said this was one of the main reasons why he was destroying those nations that were in Canaan, and said, if you do it, then I'm going to do that to you, which is what happened. But then now, as we're into the reign of King Ahaz over Judah, what's introduced now into the kingdom of Judah for the first time by him? That practice. And we already got a preview last week of looking at what happened later. He's the one that started it, and it has to start somewhere. I mean, when for leaven to get in the lump, which it will eventually leaven the whole lump, is the danger. But that leaven has to get introduced, doesn't it? Somebody's got to introduce that leaven in there. Well, who's the one that first introduced the leaven into Judah? Ahaz. Now, it's not going to leaven the whole lump under him, but the leaven is there now. And under his grandson, Manasseh, what's going to end up happening to the lump? It's going to be filled with it. And the Lord's going to destroy Judah for that. And we looked at several scriptures in 2 Kings, as well as in the book of Jeremiah and Ezekiel last week, where the Lord pointed out that practice and said he would not pardon the shedding of that innocent blood. And over again, God pointed to that, what they were doing to their children and murdering them as part of their idol worship through the fire, that he was not going to pardon that. And that's why he was going to destroy them. And ultimately, of all the 12 tribes of Israel, I mean, how much was left of the northern kingdom? I mean, they were gone permanently. And then of all of Judah, what was left of them, it was only a remnant. So of all of the tribes, only a remnant was preserved in the end. We don't want to get the mistaken idea that, well, most of Israel survived, but there were some who ended up being destroyed for following after wickedness. No, it was the vast majority of all of them that were ultimately wiped out and destroyed. And there was only a remnant of them all that got preserved in Babylon, that was brought back and God restarted with them. But it ended up destroying almost all of them. Well, what can happen to us? We don't just read this as, well, that's a terrible thing that happened back then. Okay, let's turn the page now and read what comes, what happens, what's the next story. I mean, these aren't just stories. These are accounts of what really happened, with a lesson for and a warning for all of us. We better look out, because we're in a wicked world too. And what destroyed God's people then, the same things. The devil's using the same tactics and methods and wiles on us, and it will destroy us today just as it did them if we are not very vigilant looking out for those and putting on the Lord's whole armor to resist the wiles of the devil. Now with that, we can and will prevail, but we've got a lot to do, and it's going to start with us being aware and have that knowledge and understanding and wisdom to know what to be on the lookout for and what we should do so that we can overcome in all of these things, and our children also. So back to 2 Kings chapter 16. Verse 3 is where we left off last week about Ahaz, when it says, "But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and made his son to pass through the fire according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel." And he's going to end up casting out Judah as that practice overtook them. But Ahaz is the one that starts it. So verse 4 says, "And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and under every green tree." So verse 3, I mean, it really went right to the worst of the things that he did, but it doesn't give the full detailed explanation of all the wickedness that he practiced along with that. So that's what these verses now from 4 on down are going to give us a great detail about Ahaz and the wickedness that he engaged in his lifetime. So we know that he was, in addition to sacrificing his children in the fire, he was sacrificing and burning incense in the high places and hills and under every green tree. Was Ahaz religious? Yes, he was. I mean, he false religion. He was, but I mean, was he casual about his religion? I mean, he was. It's when we read this, I mean, he's very devoted to his false and wicked religion. So this is just another reminder. Being religious, look at what it can. Look at all the things that involves. Or can involve. This is false religion, though. So being religious when it's not practicing what is authorized and taught by God, I mean, it's evil and wickedness. So does anybody get, are they going to get some kind of bonus points from the Lord because they are religious or have zeal for their religion when it's false? No, this is, it's fat, it's the opposite. This is something pointed out. These are marks against Ahaz. He's describing how he was wicked. So he was very zealous in his practices with all these high places and his offerings that he was making. He's very devoted to these idols. So verse 5 says, "Then Rezin the king of Syria and Pekah the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war. And they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him." So verse 5, is the king of Syria? And so here's Rezin the king of Syria, and he's made a league with Pekah the son of Remaliah, who's the king of Israel. At the time, and of course he's the one that's going to be killed by Hoshea, which that was recorded in the previous chapter in verse 30, but until Pekah is murdered by Hoshea, it's Pekah and along with Rezin, the king of Syria, they're allied against Israel, and they came up to Jerusalem. So they didn't just encroach into Judah, they were successful enough in an invasion that they came all the way up against the capital city of Judah, which is Jerusalem. And they came up to Jerusalem to war. And they besieged Ahaz. So now they've laid siege to Jerusalem. So when have we read of anything like this in Judah's history since the kingdom was divided after Solomon's death and his descendants from Rehoboam down now to Ahaz? When have we read about Jerusalem herself being under siege from her enemies? This is a degree of encroachment against Israel by her enemies that we've not read about up to this point. Why are we seeing? I mean, we've certainly seen during times, for example, when Jehoshaphat's son Jehoram, who had married the daughter of Ahab, Athaliah, during his time, we read about the enemies of Judah that started coming against them, when Rehoboam, Solomon's own son, when he turned away from the Lord after 3 years after he became king, then the Egyptians came against him, so we've certainly read about times when under the wicked kings that Judah had, that the Lord brought their enemies against them. That was in fulfillment of what he had promised to do to them if they didn't keep his commandments, that their enemies would come against them one way, and then God's people would flee before them seven ways, where the opposite would happen if they kept his commandments. So God had promised them they would lose, their enemies would rise against them, they would have famine, they would lose land if they were in rebellion against him. So we've seen examples of it, but have we seen it to this degree? No. So why would it be to the worst we've read about now? Well, they have the worst king we've read about up to now, don't they? I mean, Ahaz has his wickedness exceeds any of the ones before him that we read about. So should it really be a surprise that now the Lord is sending their enemies against him, and it becomes a level of threat that they hadn't seen before, right up to besieging Jerusalem herself? Well, that shouldn't be a surprise. But was it God's will at this time for Jerusalem to fall? It was not. And so what was the end result of that? Did God use reason and Pekah to punish Ahaz and Judah for this wickedness? Yes, he did. Did Pekah and reason, did they have designs or plans to go beyond what they were able to do here? Did they want to do more than just besiege Jerusalem? Well, yeah, we've already read about that. Pekah wanted to conquer the whole thing. He wanted to completely subjugate Judah. He wanted all the territory of Israel under himself. So that was his grand design, his grand plan. But did he succeed in that? No, that was not God's will to fulfill his desires. So who's got control over all of this then? Is he taking reason, this king of Syria, and Pekah, the king of Israel, and is he dragging them against their will down to Jerusalem and saying, I want you to punish this wicked King Ahaz here in Judah, but we really are content with our own land, Lord? No, that's not what it was. They wanted to do this, so did God. Did he use their own desires and wickedness as a means of punishing Judah for her wickedness? Yes, that's what God... This is a glimpse, another glimpse, another example of how God works in this world. In our time, you know, what's all in the news right now? It's like you got Russia invading Ukraine, and they're besieging their cities and doing all this, and the world's in a tizzy over what's going on over there. Does the Russian guy want to take Ukraine? Is he being dragged over there against his will? No. kingdom. What's going to happen? Well, we don't know what's going to happen yet because we don't know the future, do we? But what do we know? I mean, who's in control of all this? God's in control of all that. Now, what are his plans, and how is he using these different nations, and what is he ultimately going to do with all of this? Well, those are the things we don't know right now, because we don't know what's coming today or tomorrow, and beyond that. But what do we know? Well, we know that the Lord's doing this. I mean, the Lord has a reason for what he's doing, and he's using these different rulers and these different nations right now at this present time, just like he was then. I mean, if we'd been in some other nation, and we'd had and there were all the kinds of communication stuff that are available to us now, we'd been sitting in our living rooms or wherever at that time, and be able to see or hear about, read about what's going on then. I mean, we would have known about this Syrian king is with this king of Israel coming against this land of Judah and Jerusalem. That would have been in some news around then. Well, what would we have seen with our eyes that would have said, well, here God is doing this for this reason? Well, that wouldn't have been so obvious, would it? That's not something we could have seen with our physical eyes. But who was doing this? God was bringing these two against Ahaz to punish Ahaz for his wickedness. It was the desire of those two to do much more than that. Well, just like Putin in Russia today, he wants all of Ukraine. Is he going to get it? He may or may not. We don't know yet. But he wants it, doesn't he? Well, they wanted all of Judah. Did they get it? They didn't get what they wanted then. Do we ever read about some getting what they want in that? Yeah. Did Assyria want all of Israel? Yep. Did they get it? They got it. And God had a reason for that. So the Lord had his reasons for all those things he was doing, and he did them. He was doing that here. But it was not God's will for Judah and Jerusalem to fall at this point. It was his design and it was his purpose to punish them, but not yet to utterly destroy them. Were they worthy of utter destruction yet? Not by what the Lord decided. Now, eventually, Nebuchadnezzar got it and took it all, and that was his will, and he preserved the remnant in Babylon. But at this point, it's God's purpose to bring punishment, and he did, but not to give them the whole thing. So the reason came and Pekah with him was because of this wickedness of Ahaz, and they desired to take the land. But he tells us plainly there that they could not overcome Ahaz. Was it because Ahaz was that good? I mean, as far as being a strong king or a military leader, that he was able on his own to resist them? Not at all. This all has to do with one being, and who was it? It was the Lord. So the Lord is the one that brought these enemies. The Lord's the one that put the limits on what they could do. Satan was behind them, but the Lord was the one that was in control of all of that at the time. And it's the same today, which, like Brother Jan was pointing out a while ago, why we need to be praying so earnestly and fervently now. I mean, about what's going on, especially for the sake of God's people, us and God's people everywhere. But all of these events that are going on in the world when it comes to the wickedness that's advancing in our nation and around the world, and it comes to the wars and things that are going on. I mean, God's the one that's in control of all of this, and nothing happens in this world that's outside of his control. He's not just sitting back there with his arms folded, watching all of this, and, oh, I wish that wouldn't have happened. I was really hoping that wasn't going to go. That's not what God is doing. God's the one. He's made all of this. He's working all of it, and he's actively involved in every aspect of our lives, and he cares that much for us. He's He doesn't just know every hair on our head just for knowing it. It's because he cares for us that much, and he's going to take care of us and every hair on our head according to his mercy and his goodness. So we need to be asking him for that. But that should give us great courage and faith, knowing that it's that the Lord is the one in control of all of this. It's not just this world, even no matter how chaotic it looks, it's not just running off there on its own. Because if it really were, I mean, how much worse would it be? If the devil could do all that he wanted to do, and if men, wicked men who, of course, they're serving the devil, if they could do all that they wanted to do, I mean, what would this world look like? It would be, there'd be no organization. I mean, it would just be complete and utter mayhem and chaos out there. We wouldn't be able to, we couldn't safely gather anywhere. I mean, it would just be utter, I don't think we can even imagine what it would really be like, but that's not God's will for this world to be like that. So he's got control over it all, and now we don't know what he specifically is going to do. We do know what his goals are and how he works, and ultimately what he's doing with the wicked is to put them under his footstool, and with those who love the Lord and will glorify him as God and seek and serve him with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, he's going to conform them to the image of his Son. So we know he's got that overall work, and everything, all the other details are involved in that. But as far as the particulars of any situation, we don't know in advance how that's going to fit into his overall purposes with any one of us or the world as a whole. But we do need to ask the one who's in control for all of our sakes. Well, God did spare Jerusalem and Judah under Ahaz in spite of his wickedness. They couldn't overcome Ahaz. Verse 6 here in 2 Kings 16 says, at that time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Elath to Syria and drave the Jews from Elath. And the Syrians came to Elath and dwelt there unto this day. So the Syrians regained something that obviously those that were from Judah had occupied this Elath, but that was recovered by Rezin to Syria. But God did not let the Syrians or Pekah and the kingdom of Israel take over Judah and Jerusalem. Now, in this time of his distress, who should Ahaz have turned to? What would have been the proper way to look at his situation if he were one that had any mind whatsoever to look at things in a proper way when he's doing all these things that he's doing, which are wicked, and all of a sudden his enemies are right there on his doorstep? What's the right way to look at that situation? Yeah. What am I doing? Am I doing something wrong here? What am I doing where now I've got this trouble? Is there what do I need to look at myself and identify as maybe a cause for this? Is God doing this? And well, that he should be recognizing, of course, this was God's work. And if he was thinking at all about what God had said and had promised them and what he had foretold, as Brother Johnson just said, that this was fulfillment of what God had said exactly he would do if they didn't obey him. So if he had any knowledge of that at all, I mean, this God said if we obey him, we're not going to have trouble. We will prevail over our enemies, not them troubling us. But if we don't obey him, then we're going to have the enemies come against us. Our enemies have come against us. That must mean we're not obeying God's commandments. What are we doing wrong here? What commandments are we not fulfilling? What commandments are we breaking? What are we doing? It's against the will of God. I mean, that would have been the right way to look at this. And then if he had thought about that, how difficult would it have been to, for him to have started identifying the particular things that he was doing wrong and then repent of them, and then what would happen in his situation? Well, then the punishment would end. Now, God put a limit to the punishment. Was it because of that Ahaz was righteous and repented? No. It was not God's will to bring full destruction at that time. But that was not because Ahaz was righteous or repented. That would have been the right thing for him to do. If he were thinking properly at all, his thoughts should have turned toward the Lord and then to examine himself to see what he was doing wrong and why the Lord was sending his enemies against him so that he would learn how to repent. That's not what he did. Who did he turn to when things were going wrong here? In verse 7, it says, "So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, 'I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me.' And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria hearkened unto him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried the people of it captive to Kir and slew Rezin. And King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar there that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. And Uriah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Urijah the priest made it against King Ahaz, came from Damascus. And when the king was come from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached to the altar and offered thereon. And he burnt his burnt offering and his meat offering and poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings upon the altar. And he brought also the brazen altar, which was before the Lord, from the forefront of the house, from between the altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of the altar. And King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, saying, 'Upon the great altar burn the morning burnt offering and the evening meat offering and the king's burnt sacrifice and his meat offering and the burnt offering of oil of all the people of the land and their meat offering and their drink offerings, and sprinkle upon it all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice, and the brazen altar shall be for me to inquire by.' Thus did Urijah the priest according to all that King Ahaz commanded. And King Ahaz cut off the borders of the bases and removed the laver from off them and took down the sea from off the brazen oxen that were under it and put it upon a pavement of stones. And the covert for the Sabbath that they had built in the house in the king's entry without turned he from the house of the Lord for the king of Assyria. Now the rest of the acts of Ahaz which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Ahaz slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Hezekiah his son reigned in his stead." So that's all the 2 Kings has to say about Ahaz. But the rest of that chapter tells us how he responded to the king of Syria coming against him with Pekah, the king of Israel. Well, God stopped them. But instead of turning to the Lord, Ahaz turned to the king of Assyria for help. And the king of Assyria helped him. Well, for whose purposes? I mean, this was fitting into the Assyrians' plans. We went through some time ago looking at some of these kings of Assyria. Mm-hmm. And we know that there was Pul, he was the first one that we read about, the king of Assyria, back in 2 Kings 15 and verse 9, who took tribute from Menahem. And then after him was Tiglath-Pileser. He was the one that came against in Pekah's time. And so we can see Tiglath-Pileser, when we add what we learn here in 2 Kings 16 with what we were told in 2 Kings 15 in verse 29, Tiglath-Pileser did come against Syria and Israel. What did he do with Rezin, the king of Syria? He killed him. So he conquered Damascus and killed Rezin. And what did he do against Pekah in the kingdom of Israel? Well, here was Pekah, who was, his mind was to conquer Judah and take it over. Well, then Assyria comes against him and does what with his land? Well, he takes all those tribes on the east side of Jordan away, and from Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and carry them captive to Assyria. So instead of gaining land, he loses it. Well, is that because God was so pleased with Ahaz? No, but what kind of man was Rezin? I mean, Pekah, well, Rezin too. They were all wicked. So God is using the wicked king of Syria, the wicked king of Israel, to punish the wicked king of Judah, and then he takes the wicked king of Assyria to punish the wicked king of Syria and the wicked king of Israel. So God's using all of them against each other, and he's punishing them, all of them. Well, the only one that's not getting punished yet are the Assyrians, but that's coming later. God's going to render his judgment against them too. But does God use all these different kings and nations and people in his work? Yeah. What would we know about this and how all that fit into God's plans and purposes if he didn't tell us all of this? I mean, we would just maybe know historically there was a war over and involved some different people, but I mean, he's telling us and teaching us how he works and why, how he does what he does and why. Are these miracles that he was doing here? These were not miracles that he was doing there. This was God using different ones by their own purposes, and as it fit into what God's plans were, he would permit them to do certain things that they designed to do. But where it didn't fit into God's purposes, then he stopped them and then punished them and brought things against them that they very much didn't desire to have happen. And so God was using all of these different ones. And how many different things is he doing at the same time? So was God actually blessing Ahaz's efforts to in turning to the Assyrians? No. On the surface, somebody might say, well, yeah, the Assyrian king, he ended up hurting these enemies of Ahaz. Well, he did, but is this going to help Ahaz in the long run? No, what it's going to do is now, instead of his big problem being Rezin and Pekah, now his big problem is Tiglath-Pileser. So he's just really transferred which enemy he's going to have to deal with. And what does he have to do to get him to help him? When we read from 2 Chronicles a little bit later, Lord willing, next week, in fact, when we want to go to 2 Chronicles chapter 28, and there's going to be more information about Ahaz and his reign there, and he's going to be very clear that what Tiglath-Pileser did actually didn't help Ahaz. It's going to end up hurting him. He's turned to the wrong ones. And how often did Israel do that when they would have trouble and they would turn to some other man or nation, some man who was leading a nation? And over again they did that with the Egyptians. But whether they turned to Pharaoh or whether they returned to the king of Assyria, I mean, how often do we see Israel, when they're wicked, they're turning to other men for their help and looking for help elsewhere, anywhere but from the Lord? And that's what Ahaz does. And it's ultimately going to not help him, but hurt him. It does hurt Rezin and Pekah, for sure, and their kingdoms. What is the immediate price for Ahaz? What does he have to do to get Tiglath-Pileser's interest? He's got to give him all this silver and gold from out of the temple. And from the treasures of the king's house. So he's having to empty his own treasures and then take what was the Lord's and buy off this Assyrian king to get his help. And so he's, all that goes to Assyria. What a shame that is, what God had been given for the Lord, for his temple there in Jerusalem. And that's now given to go to Assyria and their wicked king to try to buy his help instead of getting the help from the Lord, the one who could truly help him. This is all very sad. Furthermore, he goes and meets with Tiglath-Pileser, his so-called helper, and they meet in Damascus, and then he sees this altar that's there in Damascus, and then he gets, in essence, what would be the blueprint for it, and gets a copy of it made in Jerusalem, and then takes the Lord's, his altar, and the brazen altar and sea and all that, and takes that out of the temple and its place for the Lord and joins it. So he makes this grand altar and using the very things that are supposed to be serving the Lord to go with this idolatrous altar that's copied from Damascus. Now, how's this any different than what Amaziah did, which would have been Ahaz's great-grandfather? You remember what Amaziah did? He conquered Edom. And what did he do? He took those so-called gods from Edom that he had just defeated and worshiped them. And the Lord sent the prophet and questioned him with his foolishness. Why are you worshiping these gods that couldn't even help the Edomites against you? What is he? Here he hires the king of Assyria to try to help him against the Syrians. They come in there, conquer Damascus, kill Rezin, and then he says, okay, now I'm going to take their altar and copy it, and I'm going to do what they were doing as far as their practices. Well, how did it help the Syrians? Rezin is dead. Damascus has fallen. But now worshiping and serving those gods on a blueprint or a total copy of that altar in Jerusalem now is going to help Ahaz, especially when he takes what belongs to the Lord and joins that to make that part of this worship. How foolish is that? I mean, he's learned nothing from what Amaziah did. Here's example number two from one of the kings of Judah following after or adopting some practices of nations that were their near neighbors who fell and weren't even helped by these ones that they're serving. I mean, what strong does the delusion have to be? It has to be super strong, but it was. But it would have to be a strong delusion to believe a lie that big. But Amaziah believed it, and now Ahaz is believing the same lie. But it is a lie. And now what is the Lord going to think of that when he's doing that and then taking what's from the Lord's own temple to join it with this? I mean, this is why Ahaz is described as he is. I mean, he is the most wicked king we've seen in Judah. And there's more to look at in as far as his wickedness. So, Lord willing, next week we'll look at chapter 28 in 2 Chronicles to learn some more about this wicked king of Judah.